Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, baby. Hello, rebel baby. Hello, my baby. Today.
Welcome to Season 2, Episode 2 of Brown Baby Podcast with this week's guest, Ben Bailey-Smith. I don't know why I said it in that weird way. I'm your host, Nikesh Shukla, and I have spent the day perfecting my Larry David impression in a rare empty house, a rare empty house. I think you can hear from my strained voice how hard I've been practicing, and I must say that the impression is now pretty bad. Still, it's still pretty bad. So this is a podcast about parenting. And each week I ask the question, how do we raise our kids to be joyful in bleak times that make us so sad and angry? And each week I don't just sit here fighting myself with existential dread about that very question. I invite a parent on to chat to me about their journey, how they're navigating their tricky times with these kids of theirs, how to have big important conversations and how to still have fun and enjoy the world. This is a hopeful podcast about parenting. It's inspired by my memoir, Brown Baby, a memoir of race, family and home, which is out now. It's been out since February. Please, please buy a copy. I don't care where you buy a copy. As long as it's a legal copy, not a pirate copy. I mean, why would you pay for a pirate copy? Surely, like... Anyway, what I'm trying to say is, please buy the book. I don't care where you get it from. Get it from the A site. Get it from a big chain. Get it from a supermarket. If you find it in a supermarket, just get it, please. I'd love for you to get it. Before I introduce this week's guest, all I am going to do is just tell you about ways of supporting the podcast, which is free. I record it myself. I edit it myself. I promote it myself. I upload it myself. And I'd love some support, man. So yeah, buy the book. That's one way you can support the podcast. Buy my book and also buy Ben Bailey-Smith's book through the bookshop.org affiliate link that's in the show notes. There's also an Acast supporter function where you can support the show or just tell a friend. Shout about us on the internet. Rate us 5 stars. Subscribe. Tell other people to get the books or even just get them from the library if you're not able to purchase them. That's also cool. So yes, as I said, this week I bring you Ben Bailey-Smith, the rapper, the actor, the writer, known as Doc Brown. Ben has been a legend on the UK rap scene for decades, an actor popping up in places like Law & Order UK, Dez, The Split, 4 O'Clock Club. He is a stand-up and he is now a writer of hilarious kids' books like the recently released Something I Said, which is a hilarious book about a 13-year-old boy called Carmichael Taylor who goes viral when he makes fun of his family. It's really, really funny. And I urge you to read it if you have kids with a sense of humour or if you want to read a book that'll make you laugh while you read with your kids. Get this book. It's brilliant. We spoke about Ben writing lyrics for Snoop Dogg. Yes, he wrote the Just Eat advert lyrics. I don't know if you've spoken about it publicly since we've recorded, but he speaks about it on this. He talks about being a dad of daughters who are way more progressive than him, his childhood comedy routines with his big sister Zadie Smith, my personal hero Zadie Smith, hopefully future guest of the podcast. Zadie Smith podcast. I mean, if Zadie Smith is listening to this thinking, should I go on this idiot's podcast, and she just heard me mispronounce the word podcast, she's probably thinking, nah. Anyway, he also talks about his early years on the rap battle scene, which is where I first came across him. I love Ben. I've been a fan since his days hosting an open mic at Deal Real Records in central London that I was always way too scared to jump up on, and I'm glad I didn't, because as time has told, I wasn't a very good rapper. I think he's a great, hilarious, warm-hearted guy. We talk about so much stuff. You know, he has a really wonderful message about laughter and about love at the end. And it filled my heart with joy. The sound quality is a little wonky in places because it was one of those recordings where I had to just take the Zoom recording rather than our individual recordings for various technical reasons. I'm sorry about that. Hopefully the content and Ben is a warm and generous enough of a guest to just help you get past that. I just thought I'd be honest and transparent and warn you now. Whoa, this has been going on a very long time, this intro. Great. Okay. Season 2, episode 2, Brown Baby Podcast, Ben Bailey Smith. Let's go.
And Nikesh, there's no rush. I've got like 2 hours to kill now because I've got a medical to go to, and so there's no rush out.
Okay. I've got rush because I've got to do
I've
got to do the school run at 3.
Being
a dad and all that.
No worries.
Cool. Well, welcome to the podcast, Ben. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, man. Like it's one of those periods of my life that is very manic. I suppose it's probably predictably manic to people who know me, who think I'm doing a billion things at once. And I never really am. I do different things at different times, and then things come out at the same time and people are like, oh my God, you do like this, you do that, you do this, how you do, you know. Actually, I tend to do one thing at a time, but today is one of those days where I'm having to do a lot of different things in one day, which I do find stressful because I'm not a multitasker despite appearances, you know.
So last year when the pandemic hit, and I'm imagining, like me, you're one of those parents who's like, there's so much going on, often you have to do stuff at night or go away for an evening, or just like work 12 hour days that start at 2 and go on until the evening and stuff, and so you end up doing all of your parenting at the weekends in like intense bursts when you're really, really tired and stuff. Did you find that just being at home all the time, did you find that a fruitful time for you, or did you find that really difficult?
I think the simple answer to that is both. But there's more complexity behind it because I was already contracted to write a novel for Bloomsbury, which I was really sort of scared about because I've never done it before. And before the first lockdown, before I even knew what COVID was, I was thinking, how am I going to do? I mean, just finding the time's gonna be difficult. You know, I was doing a lot of filming and shooting, takes up so much of your time each day. And then obviously, my kids and I just moved house. And I just had a lot going on. I thought, when am I gonna do it? You know. So when the lockdown happened, it was a godsend to suddenly have all this time. And I was on 2 shoots, they both went down. So I was just, it was like this God-given chunk of time. The reason I say it was both is because being handed the time was like, now there's no excuse, which I found that a hugely pressurizing position to be in. But eventually, you know, just that time ticking down towards the day of delivering the first draft, which was in, I think, the middle of the summer last year, 2020, you know, pressure is good for me. Like, it forces me to work. So like every morning I just, you know, I'd get up, make sure the kids were all right, and then I'd go up to my little office and just hope that something came out. And some days it didn't, some days it did, and on days that it didn't, I just tried not to be too mean to myself. You know, I just tried to be gentle and say, look, you know, you only wrote your words today, but if you tried to force out 1,000 words, they would have been 1,000 rubbish words. So, you know, try and just be nice to yourself because it's not easy.
In a way,
it was an absolute godsend, and I was so happy to get it done by the end of the summer, because in August my first shoot was back up and running, you know. So I was out there again in the world working, which, you know, feel incredibly privileged to have done. But that's because the film industry and the government had come to an agreement pretty much before almost any other industry. You know, we had mass testing in place and strict PPE and safety guidelines in place before pretty much anyone. I mean, it made me feel awkward at times because, you know, my wife's a teacher and they still haven't really had the protection I think they deserve. And the same with, you know, nurses, doctors and nurses. So it's a bit like I'm an incredibly just privileged dude, really. But yeah, we were up and running. So to get the first draft off before that happened was incredibly satisfying.
Yeah, it one of the things that I've referenced quite a lot, hilariously talking to the brother of said essayist, but when Zadie's book of essays Intimations came out, there's that one essay.
What a book that was.
An amazing book. And like there's that one essay where she's talking about the fear that she feels that her partner and children are going to find out how she spends her days. And I really remember feeling that, because like there are parts of my days where I need to watch something on Netflix. There are parts of my days.
And also, dude, what's a huge part of our job? A huge part of our job, in inverted commas, is like staring out the window, you know? Or like sometimes I like pick at an ingrown hair in my arm. Yeah, you know, it's like half an hour. And I'm just like, I'm actually thinking, like I'm trying to solve a plot issue, or do you know what I mean? I'm thinking of a gag, but that's what I'm doing. And if you walk in at that point, I've rolled up my sleeve, I'm just picking an ingrown hair in my arm. As a teacher, I mean, my wife worked harder during the lockdown than she did when she's in school. Seriously, longer hours, or, you know, she walks in and I'm doing that. It's just like, really?
Yeah.
So yeah, I related to that.
Yeah, it's almost like having to find that button on your laptop again that makes everything go away, like you're a teenager stealing a few minutes to watch pornography on the family computer.
Exactly that, yeah.
So the book is well, by the time this comes out, the book will be out, Something I Said, which is about a young stand-up who goes viral. Given that you've been like in the public eye, you know, since you were, you know, really young, and you know, you've been performing and all the rest of it, was that, you know, your early start in front of a microphone, was that something that kind of made you think, I want to write about a kid who just picks up a microphone and tries to find their voice?
Yeah, it was kind of, you know, I just went by the old adage of write what you know. But I knew before I put pen to paper that I wanted to, that I was going to write for middle grade, for older kids. So I just thought, well, what are the two things I know about? You know, I know about being a 13-year-old boy because I was one. And I know about being a stand-up because I was one. So it was a matter of combining those two in an accessible way. So I didn't want him to be famous. I didn't want him, I mean, like you said, he goes viral. Without a spoiler, he actually doesn't go viral. Like there is no real success, but he has a brush with success that I think is the thing that perhaps grounds the story and makes it less of a fantasy. It's a very real world story. And I also knew I wanted to do that from the beginning. I knew I didn't want any dragons. I didn't want any portals to another universe. You know, I wanted to have really real kids doing really real things, but with something extraordinary in there, you know. But there's nothing in there that couldn't possibly happen to any kids. So that was my main focus from the beginning, and just keeping it grounded throughout. And the other thing I was determined to do was to have a big laugh on as many pages as possible, if not every page. That was key.
Do you remember the first time you picked up a microphone? I mean, obviously you started off as a rapper, but you know, there was always so much humor in your raps and in your freestyles. But do you remember that first that first moment?
I mean, it actually goes back really, really far. Like when I was about 6 years old was the first time I remember wanting to be an entertainer. Like I wanted to be on TV or on stage. I really recall that. I either wanted to be like an actor or a milkman. Those were the two things I was really up for doing. And you know, seems like a very sort of 6-year-oldy thing to think, like, you know, famous or milkman. But actually, I saw the two jobs as being quite similar when I was that age. And I'm looking back, I feel the same now, you know, that kind of doing your own thing. You're very singular, like going around bringing sort of joy in the form of milk and orange juice to people, and being a bit of a character. So yeah, like me and Zadie, I remember when we were like 7 or 8, we would learn sketches from television, comedy sketches, Monty Python, 40 Towers, Porridge, Fry and Laurie, whatever our dad was into, really. He was a big comedy buff. And we'd like learn the lines and perform them, like, you know, just do two-handers in the living room whenever like there was an aunt and uncle around or anything, bang, we'd be on. And, you know, Zadie carried on like doing tap dance and singing. And I loved acting in the school plays. So we were both little performers, really. Any excuse, I'd love to get up in front of people and ideally make them laugh or just entertain them, like just get a round of applause. I guess we were both just really needy kids in need of that vindication, who knows. But yeah, and then yeah, as a teenager, writing rhymes, I just kept it to myself. I didn't feel confident enough to actually rap out loud because I didn't feel like street enough, you know. I looked at the boys in my school who rapped, you know, they were all like tough guys, and I didn't feel like, oh, I can't really be a part of that. But I did write rhymes, I just kept them secret. And yeah, it wasn't until like my late teens and start to go to rap clubs, and they all used to have battles and competitions in those days. And yeah, eventually just plucked up the courage to give it a go. So probably the first time I actually like held a mic in my hand would have been, you know, 17 or 18. But in terms of performing, like would have been school plays when I was like 7 or 8, I mean, and it was the same feeling. I wanted everybody to give me a round of applause, you know?
Yeah, I really remember you know, obviously I've been following your rap career for gone on decades now. And you were like one of the best to do it. And one of the things that I always really appreciated your battle persona in particular was you were never cruel and you were never like awful. You always had this really good sense of the absurd, and you're really good at like taking people down, but not like making them hate you in the process. And I thought that was such a wonderful quality that you just didn't see that much at that time.
That's really kind of you to say. And also, yeah, that was really, really important to me. And it was an instinctive decision in the battling world, because like I said, I never felt like a tough guy. I knew street guys, but I wasn't a street guy myself. And I just, you know, everything I knew about rap was like, you got to be real. You just got to be real with it. Otherwise you just get embarrassed. You get shown up and ridiculed. So, you know, I mean, I've always worn glasses, wear contacts at the minute, but you know, in those days, I didn't have contacts. I couldn't afford contacts. So I'd always have these rubbish, you know, NHS glasses. And it would be the first thing that people dissed every time. So I'd always be ready to make them look foolish. Oh, look, you've just been embarrassed by, like, the geekiest kid in your class, you know. Or so, like you said, there was real nastiness out there. I remember, like, black rappers, you know, being really, really, like, aggressive about the mixed race thing. Like, just, like, backwards racism, basically. And I'd love to bury those guys. And I remember beating one guy and saying something along the lines of like how embarrassing it was that I beat him, because I'd beaten him with my white half. That wasn't even my black half that did you there. Do you know what I mean? And that, you know, the audience loved that. And it's funny, like, not saying like I'm a genius or anything, but when I saw 8 Mile, that final scene where he spends all this time dissing himself and then the guy's got nothing left to say, that really was my approach. Not with the same level of anything close to the same level of skill, but that was it. I'd always come out and go, yep, glasses, yeah whatever, you know, too posh, whatever, like, what is it? Do you know what I mean? Like, I'd always come with that, and people really warmed to me because they were like, wow, wait, self-deprecating rap, this is different. Now that's like, you know, it's part and parcel, but and sensitive rap and all of that stuff, but back then it really wasn't. It was a really hard, overly masculine, homophobic, misogynistic, like aggressive world that I was in, and doing what I did really, yeah, it warmed people to me, and it was the birthplace of live comedy for me, because that gave me all the skills to be able to make people laugh and be spontaneous.
I remember listening to an interview that you did where you were talking about moving into comedy, and you just started working on radio sitcom, writing jokes. Was it for Rudy's Records?
Rudy's Rare Records, a Lenny Henry vehicle.
Yeah, and the producer was the one who actually suggested you go and try some of your stuff out in a stand-up.
That's exactly right, yeah.
And did you feel like you'd come home? Because you kind of like, this is something that had been way at the start of your life. And like, did it feel like a coming home, or did it feel like natural to you? Or did you have like, because I'm obsessed with stand-ups, and I write a lot about, you know, there was a stand-up character in my last novel. My next YA is about a young stand-up. I'm fascinated by the personality of, you know, if you take tragedy plus time equals comedy,
absolutely.
You know, where most artists, that you can have a multitude of reactions to the work, but a comedian, you know, the laugh, the visceral laugh is what they're going for. And so when they're presenting their pain to you, it sort of takes a special type of person. So I wonder if like, if you ever felt that thing where like that first gig goes amazingly and then you spend the rest of the gigs chasing that first gig, which is what some people told me happened.
Yeah, no, it was completely the opposite for me. I never warmed to stand up ever in the 10 years that I did it. The very first two gigs were sort of pressed upon me by that producer. He just thought like I should do it because I'm already a performer. I'm already writing gags. Like, makes perfect sense. So he kind of formed that idea of like, you know, you're a rapper, you write jokes, like put the things, it's unique, put it together. And he was right. I just never thought it would kick off in the way it did. I mean, within a year, I was making a healthy living. That's unheard of. 9 months it took me. Most comics, it takes them, you know, 4 or 5 years. I remember chatting to Michael McIntyre back then when I was starting out, and he was like, what are you talking about? He was like trying to give me some advice. He was like, next thing you should do, try and get some weekends at Jonglers or Glee. And I was like, oh yeah, Jonglers, Glee. Yeah, I do weekends there. He's like, you do weekends? Like 2 gigs a night and that? And I was like, yeah. He's like, what? But you've only been going like 7, 8 months. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. I thought that was how it goes. He was like, no. He said it took me 3 years to get into Jonglers. So I realized I was doing something different with a new energy that people hadn't seen before, because I was getting all these bookings. Stuffing cash under the mattress, it was crazy, but I just never stopped feeling nervous about it. I never stopped hating the build-up to getting on stage. It's a bit the physical equivalent, I would say, is like needing a massive poo like all day and not being allowed to go. Do you know what I mean? Just like every toilet door is closed. It's a horrible feeling in your stomach, and the fact that I never warmed to it in 10 years of doing it just made me think, maybe this isn't for you, which is bizarre, because when I'm up there and I'm flying, oh man, I'm bulletproof at times. And I had so many amazing times and amazing memories, but the only thing I truly loved was that within those 20 minutes when you've got them rolling and you're just riding that wave, everything else is about it. Writing it, traveling, waiting to go on, traveling home. I hated all of that.
And when you were starting out, your first kid was quite young. Is that right?
Yeah, I was a youth worker and I had a baby. She would have been, I got on stage first time to do stand-up February 2008. And she was born New Year's Eve 2005, which means she would have been, I don't know, three? Is that right? My maths is terrible. But she was little, and my missus was pregnant with the second one. Bear in mind, I'm a part-time youth worker. We live in a crappy little flat in Dalston. The people be listening now going, Dalston, that's so trendy. It was not. It was not at that time. It was a shithole. Yeah, she was a trainee teacher. We were struggling, man. And this baby pressure was big. And I'd done the second one of these practice gigs with this producer, this BBC producer, at these sort of private BBC nights, and convinced myself that it might be worth going into, you know, I thought there's battling in rap, there's got to be battling in comedy. And of course there was competitions, cash prizes. So I went in the biggest one called So You Think You're Funny, because the prize was $5,000, you know, not because I thought this is the way to start this, you know, empire of comedy and this fantastic career. I just thought, Jesus, I could use $5,000. Yeah, you know. And I remember coming home and telling my wife, like, I'm going to try doing this. And imagine you're pregnant with the second, you're struggling for money, and your husband's like, yeah, I'm just going to do dick jokes. Maybe that'll help. And she just didn't bat an eyelid. She was like, yeah, I mean, I always thought you could be a professional performer. Like, let's go for it. Let's see what happens, you know? And by August of that year, I was in the final in Edinburgh. You know, had agents buzzing around. It was crazy. It was such a roller coaster of a ride. And, you know, I'd like to say I got lucky, but no, I think you sort of make your own luck. In show business, I put myself anywhere where people might see me, you know. And for it to come full circle and me to become the actor that I dreamt of being when I was six, is not luck really, because, you know, casting directors will be in the shadows in a lot of comedy gigs, you know. And comedy turned into getting dramatic auditions. It's as simple as that, you know. But I worked for everything. I mean, those first couple of years, I worked my ass off. I'm talking about like 11, 12, 13 gigs a week, you know, doubling up on nights, riding around on my bicycle to get from one gig to another in London, and then driving like 350 miles to get to gigs in Newcastle or Stafford, you know. Get that money, die on my ass, even drive back. I just didn't stop.
But it's so funny how so many comedians sort of look back, romanticize that time of like where you kind of have, you know, you've got the material, and so you spend as much time as you can building up the momentum so that you are in the right place at the right time for luck, in inverted commas, to strike. But it doesn't seem romantic.
No, it's not, man. That first year, I don't care who you are, it's so hard. I mean, like I say, I was sort of on a fast track, but not because I was the greatest comedian. It was because I was so different. You got to bear in mind that I loved comedy, but I was raised on sitcoms. That's what I loved. Zadie as well. Like, I never watched stand-up before I did stand-up. I still don't watch it. I've never really been a huge fan of stand-up. Obviously I got to know all the greatest stand-ups in the contemporary stand-up world from working here in America and Canada and Australia, New Zealand, you know, and they're all amazing. Like, they do blow me away. But when I got into it, I think I had seen Peter Kay, and I'd listened to Eddie Murphy and Richard Pryor on my mum had the vinyls, you know. So, like, that was my stand-up education. So I think when I arrived, I didn't arrive fully formed on stage at all by any stretch of the imagination, but my rhythm, my cadence, everything was completely different. You know, when you watch a stand-up, you watch a young stand-up, and they're, you know, they're funny, they're fine, they're professional, but they've got that stand-up sound, do you know what I mean? And then I turned around and he said the most middle-class thing I've ever heard in my life. You know, they've just got this, you know, when a dude becomes a radio DJ and suddenly they're talking like this. We'll see you after the break. And you're like, why are you talking like that? Why are you suddenly talking like that? So I just went up and talked like me. And then obviously with the rap, people just never seen the shit before. It was just completely new. And I think that's what fast-tracked me, you know?
But also your rapping style is very naturalistic. So, you know, you've probably built up the ability to kind of be yourself in very constrained terms, like, because you have to still be able to hit the beat.
Yeah, absolutely. So like everything was sort of scientifically created, and there was a rhythm to every 20 minutes I wrote. It was precision, like German engineering, man, like how I would go from talking into suddenly rapping. And I used to love watching people's faces where they, wait a minute, what is happening? Why is he suddenly talking in rhythm? And like you say, I'd get my character across. And I think that's what, I mean, I've had a long side career in advertising and writing copy for adverts. And that was, again, born out of stand-up, because I think ad execs, people like that, agency dudes would be in the crowd, maybe just for fun, maybe they were fishing, who knows. But if you see someone who's able in 30 seconds to get a complex point across with humor, with human character, and humanity to a room of 1,000 strangers, what does that remind you of? You know, that reminds you of adverts. You know, the challenge of advertising is to do exactly that, to connect with a massive audience with your idea. See, the true genius of stand-up comedy is not making people laugh. The joke is almost neither here nor there. The genius is in narrowing the gap of understanding. So, you know, if the setup is one side of the canyon and the laugh is the other side, you know, the joke is that bridge of understanding. You're bringing the audience to a concept. So when people laughed to me from a creator's point of view, it wasn't so much that I cared that they found me funny. It was that they understood where I was taking them. You know, that laugh means you comprehend me. That comprehension is there. So therefore, you can translate that to a 30-second, one-minute advert. I'm going to make you, who doesn't know anything about me, comprehend what this product is going to do and how it's going to work for you. And you're going to enjoy it, you know. And that really has helped with the mortgage.
Yeah, I did wonder whether, like, part of you is like, I never want to do that perfect cup of tea wrap thing ever again. But the reason it works is because it's so, you know, you don't have to do much work to bring the audience with you on this thing that pretty much everyone in the audience will have some awareness of, that so that the joke then becomes about riffing on the different expectations that each of those audience members will have for it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it is the albatross around my neck, that song. But then at the same time, how can I be pompous or, you know, dismissive of it when it's also laid the foundations for everything that I've done since? You know, just that simple thing, I wrote it in maybe 8 to 10 minutes, thinking it was just another silly rap. But I wrote it for Russell Howard. I got that gig. And I thought, I better have some new shit to do. And I wrote it for that and tried it out in a couple of clubs and it killed. So I was quite confident. I wrapped it to Russell. He was like, that's hilarious. Put it on the show and the rest is history. You know, that is the bedrock of so many things I've done since. Like, I think it might be safe to say, I think I might be unembargoed now. Been in a NDA, like a contract of silence for a long time on this, but there's a massively successful international advert for Just Eat with Snoop Dogg, and I wrote that for Snoop. He learned my lyrics, and that's one of the, even though it's an advert, it's probably one of the most proudest things I've ever done, and I don't think that would have happened without the T-Rap. So you know, God bless the T-Rap in some ways. In other ways, it angers me profoundly because, number one, it's so silly. And I obviously, like every creator, you see yourself as this kind of intellectual, I've got way more to say. But what annoys me much more than that is that I wrote and performed it for the BBC. So therefore, this is the most popular thing that I've got that exists online. Millions and millions and millions of views. God knows how many now, 8, 10, who knows? I don't check these things, but a lot. And I have never made a penny off of that song because it existing on a BBC show means that they've always owned the rights. That's pretty depressing.
Shit, man.
But I've got Snoop, so they can kiss my ass.
That is fucking amazing. I did not know that.
No one knows. That's a worldwide exclusive. I might get sued tomorrow. I'm pretty sure it's okay to say now.
Well, you know, if we get in the Daily Mail, then I could really use those podcast listens. those hate listens.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I just want to sort of move on to talking about your life as a dad now, given that that's the thing of the podcast. What kind? I don't mean this in an accusatory way, even though the question is framed in a very accusatory way. What kind of dad are you? Are you fun dad? Are you disciplined dad? Are you somewhere in between dad? Or are you I'll do that and then forget to do it, dad?
I'm definitely not the third of those. I think I'm both the first two. I'm incredibly hands-on, always have been. Not so much because it's like, oh, this is the kind of dad I'm going to be. It's more happened out of necessity because my job is very silly and my wife's job is very, very serious. And all in. I mean, if you're a teacher, it's just, I know people think, oh, you're all these holidays. What are you moaning about? You finish work at 3:30. You don't. That job's like 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. That was never made clearer to me than in lockdown. Like, their emails were given out. So parents would just email you going, actually, I think you should teach like this. I don't think this works. I think you should do it. It's like, fuck off. Do you know what I mean? So she doesn't have the luxury of going, actually, I think this week I'll just muse over whether or not my next project will be a book of poetry, or perhaps I'll create a new hour of stand-up, or maybe I'll just think about it for another week after that. Maybe perhaps I need 2 weeks. Perhaps I need to have a retreat, you know? Like, she doesn't get that. She doesn't get that luxury. So what that's meant over the years, in considering, like, when the first one was born, when my first daughter was born, I was working, but I was a part-time youth worker. So even then I had time. I've always had more free and flexible time than her. That's just the fact of the matter. And what that's led to is I've always been a hands-on dad. I've always been the one that's more involved. I've always done more of the school runs because she's not available. I've always dealt with their teachers. I've always been the one who organizes the play dates. I do all the taxiing. I'm fully involved with both kids. Not saying that my wife isn't, of course. It's just different access. I'm around for emergencies. Like, I'm that guy. And on top of that, yeah, I am a bit of a disciplinarian, but I love having fun with the kids. The thing is, if you do my job, you have to be in touch with your inner child. You have to be. Sounds wanky, but it's true. Like, children know how to play. Children are artists, you know, even if they don't know it themselves. They're natural artists, all of them. And then at some point, we beat all their creativity out of them with how shit the world is. You know, I mean, I can't wait to read, you know, your Brown Baby book, because I think that would be a big part of it without trying to second guess what you've written. Like, it's a depressing world. And yet kids are just, oh man, especially the little ones, the things they say, the way they view the world, it's incredible, and it's beautiful, and it's inspiring. So I think the great performers, the great writers, the great artists, they hang on to something of that. You know, it's not about being childish, it's about being childlike. I think Michael Jackson said the same thing. Obviously, that's tainted now with everything that happened with him. But I think it's fair to say, even with all the horrible side of MJ, he definitely did creatively retain that childlike wonder. You know, I always remember when he did the famous Motown 25 and showed the moonwalk to the world for the first time, and Fred Astaire, like, his jaw dropped in the front row. You know, what the hell is this? He was wearing just a jacket that he'd found in his nan's wardrobe. It's just like a sparkly old lady jacket, but with the lights at the venue down on it, it made him look magical, like otherworldly. Like, only a kid would think of doing something like that. You know, like us, like, if you're like, I don't know, a lesser performer than Michael Jackson, you're probably thinking, let me speak to my stylist, or let me speak to this label, maybe they can get me this $5,000 jacket that I can wear in this big show, or for the Oscars, or the Met Ball, or whatever it is. MJ was just like raiding his nan's closet like a little kid would, to put on a show in the living room. Like, that kind of thing is what I mean, you know, holding on to that childlike creativity. Not easy to do, but to be a dad and to be in show business is great, because it does two really fundamental things. One, it grounds you. You can't be like a crazy aloof superstar. You just can't. No matter how famous I get, I still got to go to like parents' evening. Do you know what I mean? I don't believe in private schools, so I'm not going to be at the same school as the Beckhams. Do you know what I mean? I'm going to be in a state school dealing with state school shit, no matter how famous I am, right? So it grounds you. You can't just hide in your mansion. You've got to be out there in the world. And then secondly, it keeps you constantly connected to that brilliant, innocent, wide-eyed energy that I think you need to create. So it's a beautiful thing being a dad as an entertainer, but it's not without its issues as well, of course.
Yeah, and I like what you're saying about that childlike thing, because I think it also helps when you're having to have difficult conversations with your kids about the way the world works. I really remember, I know I've spoken about this on the podcast before, but like my daughter, I live in Bristol, my daughter goes to a school that's associated with Edward Colston. She's 6 years old. She's coming back asking questions about Colston, about the Bristol bus boycotts and everything. And I remember at the time thinking, I'm going to have to explain racism to her. And as I was explaining it to her, she just didn't understand. She was just like, I don't get what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. This doesn't make any sense
to me. And I realized that I was kind of projecting my cynicism and my jadedness and my world weariness at professionally having the conversation for like however many years onto this poor kid. And I just needed to look at the world through her eyes. And it was a really grounding moment for me, because I was like, this is how you talk about this stuff. You explain the world to your kids as it makes sense to them, not as it makes sense
absolutely
to you.
Absolutely. It's one of the classic parental mistakes that we all make. And the fact that children don't understand racism and it has to be explained to them is profound, you know, in that they're like, but what do you mean? Why is that person different from me? They're just, you know, we both like apples or whatever it is. And there's beauty in that. What's fascinating is when you get into my zone, my girls are teenagers now. They're more woke than me. Do you know what I mean? Like, I thought I was the liberal. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, they're way more woke than me. Like, so they pull me up on stuff all the time. Dad, you can't say that. Like, it'd be like, oh, spaz. And they'd be like, Dad, that's really offensive to people with disabilities. You're like, oh, shit. And I'm thinking, like, when I was their age, it used to be standard. Like, if something was rubbish, you say it was gay. I mean, and that's like crazy to think about now, right? And all the stuff we used to do, it was like a much less PC world. And shout out to PC world. And, you know, some people might say, yeah, it was better because there was more honesty. And maybe there's something in that. But I think there's also something in respect and understanding difference and celebrating difference. And my kids do that naturally. They're concerned about the environment. One's a vegetarian, one's a vegan. You know, that's not coincidental. I don't think I knew what a vegan was when I was 15, 16. Like, I don't think I'd even heard of it. So, you know, it's a different planet for kids now. Kids are much more responsible. Also, like when I was 15, 16, like my eldest daughter's age, I was getting quite fucked up, man. You know, I would drink cider till I puked, smoke cheap hash. Like, I can't imagine that. Like, I'm sure she will at like uni or whatnot, but the age has moved for that stuff. Like, all the 15, 16 year olds I know are super healthy, man.
That's what I was just about to ask you. Do you see them replicating mistakes that you made as a teenager? And part of you has to be like, I'm just going to hold it down because I remember what it was like at the time. Or do you?
Yeah, I just think it'll be for them, it'll be a little bit later. Obviously, they're girls as well, so it's slightly different. The younger one, 13-year-old, she was out campaigning for sexual safety for women the other day. You know, it's a real concern for them. So, for girls, there's that extra thing they have to worry about that it's never even crossed our minds. Well, of course I'm going to walk down that street. What are you talking about? You know. Whereas for girls, they've got to think, wait, hold on a minute. You know, which obviously is an imbalance that we're now looking at. Better late than never, I suppose. So yeah, I think it will take them a couple more years to do the dumb shit that I did, but they will do it. And at that point, somehow, yeah, I have to find the maturity to go, here's why that's problematic, but you know, I don't want to be like so soft that, you know, they just go wild, but I definitely want to be able to go, interesting. You know, I did that, and here's what I benefited. You know, here's what happened to me. Like, I'm there's a part of me that's almost looking forward to that conversation. We're quite open with each other, and we talk about difficult stuff all the time. We've had the sex conversations and all of that. Like, I try and have like drink and drug conversations with them, but they're just not interested in that. They're like, why would you do that? Like, if they've ever had an inkling that I've been smoking, it's just like, oh my God, they don't talk to me for like weeks. It's mental.
That's really funny. But yeah, I hadn't realized that you had two girls. I've got two girls, and part of the book, I try to explore.
It's an issue as well, right?
Yeah. So like in part of the book, I try to explore like things that I, as a male from, you know, who grew up in a patriarchal environment, you know, things that I should be thinking about or unlearning or like, you know, considering when it comes to raising girls. And it took me down like these really weird internet rabbit holes of like these lists of how daddies and daughters should be, like these really sort of twee lists. And actually it just made me think we really need to think about how we raise boys, because so much of like,
exactly, what you put all this responsibility on girls. You need to think about this, you need to think about that, you need to act like this, you need to act like that. What about boys taking that risk factor away, because they're the ones that provide it? You know, the biggest killer of women in the world is men. Right. So let's just hold our horses there. Like, the education needs to go in the other direction, you know. And in a way, you and I should know that instinctively from being brown, from being victims of racism. We should know that we're sick, and just in the same way that we're sick and tired of having to explain why this is offensive or having to alter our behavior to be this kind of acceptable face of brownness. No, the education needs to be on the other side. And it's very, very similar, I think, with boys and girls, but even more intense, because that really is a universal problem. Doesn't matter if there's no black people in your country, like, there's men and women, you know. So it's a huge, huge one. But it's nice that conversation's being had, and it's promising to see, you know, my two teenage girls like being a part of that conversation. Like, that's a mainstream conversation now.
Yeah, one of the things that really struck me from my years as a youth worker, which finished like what, 3 years ago, I definitely found that teenagers now are having much more progressive conversations than I was, like, you know, I think probably the same absolutely. Age that we were having. But a lot of it is because the language that they now possess, or the language that's much more mainstream, like, you know, words like intersectionality or what have you, like, there's so much more in common parlance than there used to be. And so I feel like a lot of that confusion that I probably had as a teenager was because I just didn't possess the ability to have conversations about this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really remember as well, like, being their age and experiencing racism and thinking it's probably best just not to flag this up. Do you know what I mean? Which is just so sad. Like, but that was a big part of the British experience for immigrants. You know, you sort of think it's wrong. It feels horrible. I feel horrible, but I'm not going to kick up a stink about it, because it's just going to make me even more of an outcast, you know. Sad. The less that happens, that's obviously a great thing.
Also, I was a bit of a dick when I was a teenager compared to
that's the other thing. Yeah, we were dicks, man. Like, you know, boys are just like the most sort of entitled little shits, you know. That's just because that's, like you say, it's a patriarchy. We didn't even know what that word was, but we benefited from it massively.
Okay, so we're just coming to the end, so I've just got two final questions for you, then I'll get on with your day. So the first is, like, I think you've talked about this a little bit, but so one of the essential questions that I have for everyone is, how do you raise your kids to be joyful and boundless in a world that feels so bleak and that you may feel quite sad and angry about?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge question, and it's one that keeps me awake at night, most nights. My thing is, I'm constantly talking to them, and everything I find funny, especially now that they're old enough that I don't have to filter stuff, like, even if it's rude, like, everything I find funny, I share with them. And I'm not sure anyone can make me laugh these days like my kids do. Like, they just crack me up, and I feel, whenever they do, I feel like it's a little dad win, because I feel like I sowed that seed of, like, Because, you know, like girls being funny, it feels like another thing that's for too long has been restricted. You know, like a girl being funny, that's not feminine. Do you know what I mean? Like a girl making fart jokes, like that's not feminine, you know? So like I've really hard for as long as I can remember from when they were really little to just like celebrate silliness. And I make a roast every Sunday, like, religiously now, like just every Sunday we have a roast, partly because I love roasts, but mainly because it's very sort of munch and go. Do you know what I mean? It might be two of us, it might be three of us, even if it's four of us, one of us is in a rush, mum's got work to do, or I've got lines to learn, or the kids got homework, and it's sort of like fly by night, people are on their phones. The Sunday roast is like no phones, everyone's facing each other. It's an event, you know, we'll play a board game or something afterwards, or watch a movie afterwards, and everyone looks forward to it. And that's when we have our proper kind of like, let's all have a proper catch up. And there's always a laugh to be had there. So for me, it's like, we all know the world is a messed up place. You know, the saddest thing for me is that the world is inhabited by two types of people, you know, people who just want to get along and get by and live in peace, and people who for some reason don't, you know, and it seems like it's always been split into those two. And the people who don't, there's loads of advantages they can take because they don't care about the well-being of others. So they tend to be the people who end up with quite a lot of power, money and influence. Because if you don't give a shit, imagine what you could do if you didn't give a shit. If you didn't give a shit, you could go, you'd go and what would you do? Like, I don't know, maybe cheat on your wife, steal shit from other people, you know, focus on just things that benefit you personally. But if you're one of the other people, then you're always thinking about how your actions affect others. And those are the only people that I really want around me. And those are the humans that I've tried to raise. And what has happened is my kids have become way better people than me. So they're a huge inspiration for me. And all I need to do now is just keep showing them that I'm there. Like when life gets scary, like I'm there. I can't solve every problem, but I do know that I'm a hero to them. And I'm going to keep trying to live up to that. Like I don't see that as this impossible thing. I know it's really hard because we are their first role models. And when we do things like, you know, when you're like pissed off and you take it out on the kids, it's like the worst feeling ever. Like you're like, you hate yourself for that, but it's natural. And you've got to turn around, which is what I always do. Take a breath, even if it's the next day and I've finally settled down, turn around, apologize, tell them, look, daddy's not perfect, but, and I'm not going to try and be perfect, but I am going to always be there. That's the first job. Just fucking be around, you know? A lot of dads aren't. So, you know, that's the first thing. Be available. Every screw up, you know, like, what's the first thing they tell you when you're on that third pint and then things start to get deep? Oh, my dad just wasn't really around. I didn't feel like he gave a shit about me and what I was doing. You're like, oh yeah, well that explains a lot because you are a dick, you know. So, you know, that's just the first thing. Just be available. You know, they'll find something. You'll be amazed when you're an old man and your grown-up daughter is saying, oh, I just really felt my dad was preoccupied with something else and that made me go and do this thing. You'd be like, wow, I really thought I was putting the hours in. They'll find something that sort of disturb them. But that's that, you know, that can, if they're raised with love and confidence, they'll turn that into a little superpower of their own, just like we did, you know? So it's about keeping on keeping on in a world that clearly doesn't support love, doesn't respect love. It's about carrying on believing that love is the supreme power, you know. No amount of horribleness, you know, look at Israel right now. Northern Ireland looks like it's kicking off again, greed, selfishness around the globe, murder, racism, misogyny, all these horrible negative things that are all pointless, right? They're all based on things that were just made up by some douchebag thousands of years ago for his own gain, probably. You know, love is the one that I find unquestionable. And there'll be some knob listening to this thinking, oh, he's just a hippie. That's why he's never going to be a proper success. Good. If that's what you want to call me, that's what I am. I don't care. Like, love is my only master. So, yeah, just keep that going. And like I say, me and you are the same age, but I guess I'm, what, like a good 7, 8, 9 years ahead of you in parenting terms. So I can tell you with some authority, it fucking works, man. Like, it works. Love, time, attention, gentleness, smiles and jokes. It works, man. It makes good people. And we have to, Nikesh. You know why? Because we're like those guys in Lord of the Rings or one of those films where it's like there's 8 of us and there's like 1 billion orcs. And we're like, how do we win this battle? The only way to win it is to keep having more of the good guys. You know, we create some good, but we don't really need any more human beings. So ideally, I would say adopt. Just same with dogs and cats, like try and adopt. But if you can't adopt and you really do want to get pregnant, cool. Just make them good guys, man. Because there's like 7 of us against the orcs. You know, we need some more soldiers.
Ben Bailey-Smith, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you so much to Ben Bailey-Smith for coming onto the podcast. Thank you for Bloomsbury and to his management for helping us to find time in his incredibly busy schedule. And thank you to the listener for coming back for season 2. I mean, if this is your first episode, please check out the first season, which features Jay Sean, Himesh Patel, Nadia Hussain, Mira Sayal, loads more. There was also season 1, episode 1 last week with Shobhna Gulati. It's a free podcast, so do support me and Ben by buying our books. And please, please rate this podcast, like it, subscribe to it, wherever you get them. See you next week, my friends. Who are we going to have next week? Safraz Manzoor next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye, my brown babies. Goodbye, my brown babies.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.